House Resource Committee in order. Let the record reflect the time is 1 p.m. Today is Monday, February 1st, 2010, and we have Representative Tuck Kawasaki, Seaton, Guttenberg, co-chair, Craig Johnson, and myself, Representative Newman, present. Representative Edgman is excused today. But also, so we do have a quorum. Just a side note on House Bill 217, we've had some very productive discussions with the administration on fiscal notes and questions that the committee had asked earlier, so we will be covering them again on Wednesday. We wanted to make sure we had plenty of time for today's presentation from TransCanada and Exxon. So today we're going to be hearing from Tony Palmer, TransCanada, Alaska. The overview will be an update of AGEA and the upcoming open season, which we've had some new announcements on and lots of questions. So Tony, if you want to come forward and do your presentation, please. And I'd asked Tony earlier how he would prefer to go through this, and what I like to do, and I know my co-chair does, is if you see questions as they're coming up, go ahead and ask to be recognized so that we don't miss anything. So go ahead. Go ahead, Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tony Palmer. I'm Vice President of Alaska Development for TransCanada. And I'm also chairman of the management committee of the Alaska Pipeline Project. And Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I would introduce the group of folks from the project team that I have with me today.
Please.
Sitting directly behind me is Paul Pike. He's the senior project manager for the Alaska Pipeline Project. He's an ExxonMobil development company representative. Seated next to him is Patty Belosky. She handles external affairs for the project in Alaska. Sitting next to her is Jim Morse. Jim is project counsel for the project. Sitting next to Jim is Brian Dumphy. He handles public affairs for the project. And on this side is Tom Roberts, who handles our work in D.C. as well as represents our finance committee on representations in D.C. So with that, I would thank you, Mr. Chairman, and pleased to be in front of this committee for the first time in this session.
Excuse me, Tony, I just need to make sure we announce that Representative Kurt Olson is here with us, too. And if we could maybe get the contact information if people have questions of these folks.
Yes, we can do that.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to announce that it may look like we're ignoring the presentation because we're looking this way from now on, but there is a new addition to the committee room, and that we have a TV down here, so that we're not ignoring you. We are, in fact, watching your presentation, so don't think we're sleeping and nodding.
Thank
we
you.
We are, in fact, involved.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I won't check my shoelaces to see if they're untied.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and with that, I will take the opportunity to walk through a brief presentation. As the chairman described, I'd be pleased to take your questions as we go through. Last Friday in Anchorage, we went through a comprehensive media teleconference on the rollout of our FERC filing that occurred last Friday. We filed 6 or 8 inches of paper with FERC last Friday. That's all available on FERC's website and our website, and I'll come to that and show that to you as we go through. But I did want to walk you through that in summary format today and let you know just what it is we're putting forward. So in an open season, I think most of the representatives here have been involved with this project for some time, so I'm going to go over that quite quickly because I know you're very familiar with it. In an open season, the project provides potential customers with design, commercial terms, an estimate of project costs, tariffs, and timelines. What I would say is different about this project, that is normal in a pipeline open season, but normally that is done in private, in confidential, between the pipeline company and its customers. What is unique about this Alaska project, as set down in FERC terms, we've actually divulged that to the public and, quite frankly, to our competitors. That is unique. That has never occurred before, and so if you think about asking a contractor to bid on your deck, this contractor has bid, and you're now asking me to show all of my bid documents to my potential competitors, and that has actually happened. So that's a unique process as set down by FERC, and the public of Alaska and certainly any concerned citizen or other party around the world can access our entire filing on the website.
On that point, Tony, I think there was several things unique, you know, with the 20 must-haves that were required by Governor Palin at the time, and then your response back to that, and then there was some negotiation went on there, along with that, with the $500 million in reimbursements and things like that. That's a fairly unique relationship, too, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is indeed unique as well. As I've described before in front of this committee, 2 years ago we made an application, just over 2 years ago. That application became public, and all of that information, I think more than 2 feet of information, is available on all of our proposals at that time. And we obtained certain rights under the license, and we have certain obligations to the state of Alaska as a result of AGIA.
Yeah, I think that, again, because we're parting to, you know, those are Alaskans' dollars, and I think it's only appropriate they have the ability to see what's going on. Go ahead.
Yes, and we're, as we described, that material is available to them and will be available going forward through that website. So what are we seeking in the open season? Of course, we're seeking executed contracts with potential customers. That's the goal of that open season. And our open season will offer service to potential customers that want service throughout Alaska. And two options. One is to the lower 48 via Alberta, and the second option is to Valdez for LNG markets, either to the U.S. or to international markets. And I recall over the course of the last couple of years, there have been a number of parties in Alaska that very much wanted us to put forward an LNG alternative, not just an alternative through Alberta on the way to the lower 48. We have done so, and we've done so comprehensively here, and I will tell you that during that open season, any customer that wishes to have deliveries within Alaska to Valdez or to Alberta on the way to the lower 48 will have an equal opportunity. We've done an equal amount of work, and we've got comprehensive proposals for both alternatives in front of you and in front of the FERC. I'll ask you to turn to slide 3, and I want to reiterate what I've said before, that no individual commercial party can make this project a success. Any large pipeline project goes through a lengthy development stage, then if successful, moves forward to construction and ultimately to operation. So firstly, for this project, we need to succeed in the development phase. That's where we are today. Prior to open season, through April of this year, we've done a tremendous amount of work, and we'll continue to do that work to advance the materials that we've included in our FERC filing. And secondly, assuming FERC approves it on a timely basis, and we're confident that they will, we'll hold the open season from May through July of this year and conclude it on July 31st, just as we've said for more than 18 months. And then, of course, post-open season, from August on through 2014. I want to reiterate that all stakeholders in the project have important initiatives underway to advance the project. Not just the Alaska Pipeline Project, but producers, shippers, governments, plural, and others. And we need to work together to make this project a success. All parties must achieve commercial and regulatory breakthroughs for the project to succeed, not just the pipeline company. That's the nature of our business, and that's the nature of every major pipeline project, not unique to Alaska.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You may be going over this later, and if you are, I'd wait. But what type of commercial and regulatory breakthroughs, in your opinion, are necessary today that we need to change to put on the table to move this project forward?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, if you will indulge me, that is one of my slides. If I don't address it later, please ask me again. That is one of my later slides, if you're willing to wait.
Do you have a number on that slide so I can be pay particular attention, because it is very important to me?
Slide, Representative Johnson, through the chair, that would be slide 14 and 15.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and Tony, on your schedule here, where you've got your open seasons. I see you're going to be starting in April. Can we work to try and have another presentation in front of the legislature near that time before we break so that we can get updated again on where we're at?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we'd be pleased to arrange that with your office.
Thank you.
On slide four, I do want to highlight the achievements to date. How have we got to this point, and not just what the pipeline company has done, but what have others done to move us to this point? So if I look at the producers and potential shippers, over the decades, they've explored and developed gas reserves. That is a distinct advantage for this project. We have approximately 36 TCF of proven gas. It's a huge volume of proven gas for a large development project. Clearly an advantage for this project relative to some other projects. It has some disadvantages, but that's clearly an advantage. Those parties have also examined transportation alternatives and potential markets for their natural gas. They should be credited for that work that they've conducted over many years. The state, too, should be applauded for the work that it has done to come to this stage. 3 years ago, this body passed AGEA. You established the state's requirements for a major project. That's a critical factor for any large pipeline project. I will tell you that in my business, it is local opposition or local dissension that often causes large projects to go off track. Even if you have federal approval, even if you have customers, and I've said for many years that for this project to succeed, we need customers and we need regulatory approvals. You must have both. And when I say regulatory approvals, that of course includes local as well as national, and in this case for this project, international. So I applaud the work the state of Alaska has done, both the administration and legislature, to pass AGEA. Secondly, as you'll recall, I certainly do, there was a comprehensive review by the administration and this legislature of our license, and that was granted in the fall of 2008. And I understand the state, because there are royalty regulations in the AGEA requirements, they're working to finalize those as set out in AGEA. Next, I'd like to credit the U.S. government and the FERC. They have also established a legislative and regulatory structure, expedited single window structure with specific time frames to review the regulatory regime on this project. That is a tremendous advantage for this project relative to other major projects. That's in place today, has been in place for several years now, and secondly, they've also established a federal loan guarantee of $18 billion plus inflation. They should be credited for that. That's a huge advantage for this project, once again, that wasn't in place some 30 years ago. And FERC, of course, with the U.S. federal government, has set forward the FERC regulatory process, which we've now initiated. On the Canadian side of the border, we also have the legislative and regulatory structure for this project. Once again, single window, expedited project, and in fact, TransCanada, as you know, has held a certificate from the National Energy Board for this project for some 30 years. We have 25% of the project in Canada in the ground, and we've moved gas under that project for some 28 years.
Thank you, Tony. And I'd also like to recognize Representative Wilson is here for the committee and probably been busy trying to make sure we have transportation infrastructure to build these projects. Tony, when you talked about control of the gas, when Alaska has our royalty share, our 12.5% royalty share going through that, how is that, and AGEA and this pipeline, how will that be managed through here? Will the state of Alaska have full authority to control our royalty share? And I say our because I think that's what actually we can call ours, that part.
Mr. Chairman, it will be my understanding up to the state of Alaska as to whether or not they wish to take your royalty share in kind or in value. And the pipeline company will not be a party to that, but in the event that the state decides to take your gas in kind, I would expect that the state of Alaska, in that circumstance, will want to be a shipper on the project. And if so, they would be examining these terms that we've just put forward to see if they wish to be a customer. If they take it in value, they would then, I suspect, rely on the leaseholders to ship your gas. But that's clearly an issue that the sovereign, the state of Alaska, will have to determine.
And I think that becomes part of the question, because, and I'm only going to try and delve into that because it's so important for our interior folks and in some state-funded and sanctioned organizations that are working on propanes and different natural gas liquids, and trying to get that mix is that all that molecule gases that's coming up, where it's going, who gets to use that, where, I mean, that's going to get to be a pretty complicated issue, because these Fairbanks guys who are sitting here, we're all trying to help them out too to make sure that they've got opportunities as soon as possible.
And Mr. Chairman, I do want to ensure that this committee understands that we will be providing that opportunity in the open season for Alaska customers to nominate gas, whether that is the state of Alaska or utilities or industrials or other parties that wish to nominate gas or bid gas in that open season. That opportunity is there, is available to them. And as I go through the presentation, I hope you'll see that we've offered a number of alternatives for them.
Thank you, Tony.
Lastly on this slide, an important item is Transcanada has a right-of-way through the Yukon and has held that since 1983. On slide 5, I've tried to highlight what the project has done. So firstly, I wanted to indicate what other parties have done to move us to this stage, and now I thought I would hit what we have done as a project. We have said for 5 years now that we feel the best and most effective way to develop this project is an alignment of five parties: the state of Alaska, the three North Slope producers, and TransCanada. Today, as a result of the AGEA structure, we have an alignment of TransCanada and the state via the AGEA license that was granted in 2008. Last June, in June of 2009, TransCanada and ExxonMobil aligned as well. We have offered and continue to offer equity participation to BP and ConocoPhillips. You've heard me say in the summer of 2008 that any party that commits a significant volume of gas in that initial open season will have the opportunity to be an equity player with us in the project if they so choose. It's not an obligation they have, it's an option. We've continued to make that offer every time I've spoken publicly, and I assure you I speak on behalf of TransCanada and ExxonMobil. Both parties would like to see an alignment of all those major producers on this project. To date, no concrete negotiations have taken place with the other two parties.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But you basically have an olive branch, you're ready to negotiate with them. Who do you deal with? Do you deal with the producer side or the Denali? When you're going in to try to negotiate equity partnership with BP and Conoco, who are you actually dealing with?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, it is the corporate side of ConocoPhillips and BP, Representative Johnson. So not their ownership in the pipeline, but their corporate offices that would be making an equity, taking an equity position or making a decision to ship their gas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tony, Ms. Palmer, when you talked about the five partners that you would be working with, and kind of the assumption I was having on that is a large diameter and quantities over to the Alberta Hub on that, but part of AGEA also goes down to Valdez, an option for LNG exports out of Valdez, and that's part of your presentation on your costs. If you get to that point, maybe that would be a better time to cover it, but just so you're prepared. The export facility costs on that, because I think that would be another partner in that system, because you have to have an operator on the end of that pipeline for that option to happen.
Mr. Chairman, I can address that now. Is at this point, for both alternatives, both the Alberta option and the Valdez option, we don't know at this point who specifically would be customers. But clearly, those large producers could decide to put their gas in either direction. They're very sophisticated players, not just in the pipeline side, in the lower 48 market, but certainly in the LNG game as well. And they may decide, if they certainly have that option, to put their gas to the LNG option. If they do, they're clearly capable of constructing that liquefaction facility and making arrangements to take their gas to market. If another party, a non-major producer, came forward and decided that they were going to make a very large commitment to the pipeline, we'd be happy to have discussions with that party as well.
Thank you, Tony. Any other questions?
I'll move on. You know that on Friday we initiated the pre-filing. First, we initiated the pre-filing process with FERC last year, earlier than we had anticipated, but at their request. We've continued to move forward with the Northern Pipeline Agency in Canada. We've certainly initiated First Nations negotiations in Canada with the parties that have been ready to have discussions with us. We've commenced interfaces with Alaska Native groups and communities along the project corridor. And a noteworthy item, I know for some parties here, a year and a half ago, there were parties that were concerned about claims on previous projects. I can assure the committee that all of those previous claims have been removed at no cost to TransCanada, and that original partnership from 30 years ago has been dissolved. So parties that had reservations about a potential delay in the project or prevention of the project going forward because of that, and I think the acronym that people used was the withdrawn partners, that has been completely resolved, off the table, no longer there.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Palmer, a year ago when there was some questions with FERC about initiating a project, there was some reluctance to do that because of, well, costs and maybe things that would delay or there would be some loss of control with the project. Did those materialize, or and what was the extent of those, or has that did that work out amicably?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I'm pleased to tell you that we had extensive discussions with FERC staff and other representatives of FERC prior to making that pre-filing, because we did have some reservations that you've very nicely summed up for the committee. We were able to reach an amicable settlement that would resolve our concerns and meet the needs of FERC. So we've been pleased. We made our FERC filing. We think they were satisfied with that. It seemed to satisfy other parties that wanted us to take that action. And of course, today we've moved forward to actually Friday, we moved forward to make this application for our open season plan. So we've moved well past that at this point, and it's been positive for both sides in my view.
Okay, thank you. And follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And was there much additional cost, significant cost, with that process that went forward then?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I think we resolved it in such a fashion that we have agreement as to how we will proceed, that there was a modest incremental cost for the project.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Tony.
We've, as I've described today, developed comprehensive Alberta and LNG alternatives. We have complete technical cost estimates and schedules for both projects in front of the public at this point. We filed our open season, as I described, on Friday, and we completed, as required by FERC, an in-state gas study. When I say we completed, we engaged Northern Economics with ICER and SEIC to conduct that study. They completed that study. That is filed and on the FERC website, as well as our own website, and we'll be holding a technical conference in Anchorage on February the 4th at 2 p.m. And folks will have a call-in number for that as well, just like the media call we had on Friday. And certainly if you happen to be in Anchorage this Thursday, hopefully you or your staff could attend. If not, I would hope that you have someone listen in. Northern Economics and its colleagues will be conducting that technical conference. They will review the comprehensive in-state gas study that has been filed as to how they derived their numbers and how they went about that. TransCanada, as well as ExxonMobil through the Alaska Pipeline Project. Our obligation for that study was really to complete it, as FERC required, and to use the results for two things. One is some indicative offtake points for the project for deliveries to Alaska. The final results, of course, will come out in the open season. And secondly, to determine indicative tolls. What are the appropriate tariffs for in-state deliveries? We have done that. Once again, that will be finalized as a result of the open season. But all of that material is available to the public and will be used and presented on Thursday.
And on that note, if committee members have questions on that, we'll get copies of that to your offices. And if you've got direct questions regarding that, just get them through my office. We'll get them to the appropriate people.
On slide six, I'll walk through very quickly the timeline. The filing does begin a 60-day FERC review for the U.S. section. We believe that FERC will have public comments for the project from individuals as well as the public over the course of the next this month. Those comments, I will tell you, and FERC's review at this point is primarily procedural. They're not commenting on whether or not our commercial terms are attractive and the capital costs are correct. That's not what they're doing at this point. What they're doing are there are 21 requirements, and they're checking to see if we have met them. You know, do we have a design for the project? Do we have a route? Have we included capital costs, etc.? That's what they were doing, and it's fairly straightforward. We're confident, because we've met with FERC a couple of times at this stage, that we have satisfied them. But, of course, this is the first time that it's officially in front of them, and they will review and, of course, reserve their judgment. We hope that they will approve it by the end of March. If they do so, we'll move forward in April to prepare the final items and then commence our open season in May to conclude at the end of July, just as we've stipulated for more than 18 months at this point.
On the, go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The FERC review, is that statutory or is that just an average? Do they have to respond within 60 days? They have 6 days to review. Can you explain to me, is that a statutory requirement, mandatory, or is that just what they've normally been able to do?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, my understanding is they have they're expected to respond in 60 days. Every indication is that they will do so within 60 days. I think it could slip, but they're expecting to do so in 60 days. There'd be no indication otherwise that they will do that. And we're confident that we'll be able to commence the open season by the 1st of May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do want to indicate that the FERC application, of course, is for the U.S. portion of the project, and for the Alberta option, there will, of course, be concurrent Canadian open seasons for parties that want to move their gas to market via the Alberta hub or other locations. I would also tell you, because I know that there have been a number of questions from parties for some time now, that, well, what will be the outcome of this open season? And let me just hit that before taking Representative Wilson's question. When you conduct a major open season, there are really three possible outcomes. One is you get no bids. Secondly, you get unconditional bids for the full volume you'd hoped. And thirdly, you get conditioned bids. It is the norm in major pipeline projects to get conditioned bids. That's not at all unusual. That's a typical process. I also want to highlight for parties that we would, if that were the case, and that is my expectation, is we'll get conditioned bids, but we'll always wait and see what happens in 6 months' time. I've been surprised before as to what happens in open season. Maybe surprised again. If we get conditioned bids, we'll work with those customers to resolve their conditions, and our target would be to do that by year-end 2010. And I do want to highlight for parties here, because I've been asked three times since I've been in Alaska this time as to whether or not our indication that we're not going to have final open season results until 2010 is somehow related to the political schedule. Well, let me just respond to that directly. For those of you that have reviewed our application in the fall of 2007, you'll recall that we indicated in that application that we expected to conclude our open season by September of 2009. And there would be a subsequent 100 business days, approximately 5 months, where we would negotiate conditions with those customers. Well, five months from the end of September of 2009 would take us into February, right now. That had no impact on the political schedule. And you'll also recall that in our application, we had based that schedule on a desire and a hope, expectation really, in the fall of 2007, that we would receive the license by April of 2008. We did not do so. It took the administration and the legislature a little longer for your review. And because of that, the schedule, of course, was moved back. So the 100 business days is exactly the same that was in our application in the fall of 2007. And it's the case today. It's the norm that you would take several months to resolve conditions on a major project of this scale. So I just want to clarify that for the committee.
Okay, Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, you mentioned that you had the same process going on the Canadian side. Now, do you do an open season for them just like you do for us? Can you kind of explain that process to us a little bit?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes. Except there is no filing today required with the National Energy Board of Canada to get approval for the open season process. That is not required. So the FERC stage that we commenced last Friday is not required in Canada. However, assuming we get FERC approval on the timing I described, we will be conducting concurrent open seasons in Canada for the Canadian portion of the project, if parties wish that, and TransCanada's own system within Alberta will be conducting an open season as well for customers that want to get right to the Alberta hub. So all of those open seasons will be conducted concurrently and will be available to parties that want to ship their gas that direction as opposed to Valdez.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may be jumping ahead on this one, too. In your opinion, we're at a 50-50 split on the $500 million now. At what point will it become 90-10? Is it today? Was it Friday? Is it day? I mean, at what point do we start paying the 90% of the?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, prior to the open season concluding July 31st, assuming the schedule that we have now, the state reimburses 50% of our expenses if they meet the state's test. So we expend the monies first, and the state reviews them to see if they're within compliance, and if so, they reimburse us for up to 50% of the expended costs. So that would go through the end of July of this year. Post that stage, the state would reimburse up to 90% until we hit the $500 million cap, at which point the state's contribution is capped. And you'll note that TransCanada's and ExxonMobil's is not.
Representative Johnson.
You knew.
Can you tell me how much we've spent so far to date, Mr. Palmer?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I can tell you exactly how much reimbursement we have received, $1.1 million. We had spent by the end of December, this is post-license, Representative Johnson, we had spent, as I recall, something in the order of 60-some million dollars through the end of December 2009. The processing of the reimbursement was slower than we had hoped, and that was as a result of the state and TransCanada trying to resolve technical issues where we were going to transfer on a computer basis the information. We have subsequently so the number I gave you was the reimbursement through the end of Q1. The $1.1 million was through the end of Q1 of 2009. We, at the end of last week, submitted the, through the end of Q2, and we will be shortly submitting Q3 and, of course, Q4. So if you were to work the numbers through the end of 2009, subject, of course, to the state's review, you would be reimbursing us for your portion of $60-some million. I'll also tell you that as we've worked our way through the reimbursement process with the state, we've discovered that there are some issues that are very challenging from an administrative standpoint. And so items like myself, we are not charging the project. So you are not reimbursing any of my costs for this project.
I was still hoping you were on the payroll.
I thought you'd be relieved, Representative Johnson, that I was not. And secondly, we have made that same decision for employee expenses to date because the administration burden really was to such a stage that we made a decision at the project level that at this stage we have not submitted employee expenses either. So your actual reimbursement is actually less than 50% of our expenditures, but ultimately we do think that you will hit the $500 million amount as we go forward over time.
On that point, Tony, so it would be TransCanada's position that at this point in the game that the state would owe you $30 million in reimbursement. You have received $1 million, and those are only expenses that were incurred from actual expenditures after the contract was signed with between TransCanada and the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, yes, although I would not say that you owe us. You have reimbursed us for Q1 as we have submitted. We submitted Q2 last week. You will process that, and I'm confident that the state will reimburse us in about 30 days. So I think we have the mechanism in place between the two parties now to expedite that. So, but ultimately, yes, I believe that you will reimburse us for something less than 50% because of the items I described to you, so something less than $30 million out of the 60.
Thank you, and I'm glad to see that Commissioner Pat Galvin's in the audience and he's keeping the binders on you there and watching you close. And with that, maybe if the Commissioner could even get us, this committee, a little bit of a bullet point report on expenditures like that. So go ahead, Tony.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Representative Johnson.
While we have the Commissioners here, are we on budget? This is for later. Are we on budget? Have we budgeted enough? We're going to cut off in the second quarter into another year. So do we have enough in the kitty right now to cover the cost if as they're done? And you can answer that in public or private. The answer is yes.
Okay. And that was Commissioner Galvin answering yes to Representative Johnson.
My next question is how much over are we? Did we budget?
It's actually going to be pretty close, right on. And just for the members information,
Can you?
Yeah.
I mean, we need to be on the record.
Yeah.
Commissioner Galvin, I'm sorry.
Sure. For the record, Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue. On Friday, Department of Revenue distributed a report on the reimbursement fund, the status of the reimbursements, with a long, detailed list of all the different items that are part of the reimbursement. And so, if there are any questions, I would first refer you to that report because it was fairly extensive and in response to a statutory obligation. And then we can, if there's any follow-up questions, we can follow up with more information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I know staff's already taking notes right now on requesting a meeting with the revenue.
Thank you, Pat. We'll be back ready to answer this question.
Thank you, Pat. Go ahead, Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to tell you that we've been very pleased with the relationship we've had with the administration as we've worked our way through this difficult initial period where we've been trying to resolve how computers can talk to each other. If I could ask you to turn to slide 7, open season plan, I will tell you that it is our view that our application that we have made and made public on Friday provides a comprehensive, highly credible and competitive open season plan. We believe that TransCanada and ExxonMobil have unparalleled expertise and experience in interstate and interprovincial gas pipelines and gas treatment plants. You'll recall, because parties cross-examine me over the course of 2008 that TransCanada did not wish to construct that gas treatment plant. That was not our area of expertise. That is not our area of expertise, and we thought that other parties should do that. But it was a requirement of the AGEA application that we had to submit matters with regards to that plant, and also that was an integral part of the project. And we indicated that if we could not find someone else to do it, we would have to proceed with the project. Well, we're very pleased to tell you that we have what we think is the global leader in gas treatment plants, ExxonMobil, as our partner. And of course, they're leading on that side of the project. With regards to the pipeline, I will tell you that it is my belief, with no immodesty, that TransCanada is the leading pipeline company in North America. We move 20% of natural gas across the continent every day. We have $17 billion worth of pipelines in Canada, U.S., and Mexico under construction now. No other party has that. And not only do we not know how to do the engineering, we know how to get the regulatory approvals to proceed. And I will tell you, as I described earlier, customers are needed and regulatory approvals are needed. That's a critical part of the credibility of what we put forward to you. Also indicate that in addition to the significant base of work that we've both done, ExxonMobil and TransCanada, and that includes the work that we've done in Canada, and as ExxonMobil joined us, they shared with us the producer study from 2001, and that's being used for the project, and other work as well, we have done, as a team, 250,000 hours of engineering, regulatory, technical, environmental, commercial, legal, and project management work to complete that FERC filing. So more than 100 of our staff, as well as contractors, have worked for a significant period of months to prepare that material. And it's our view that that joint work has provided us with an improved understanding of the costs, scope, complexities, and risk for this large and complex project. And I'd be pleased to address those risks and the financial implications of that.
Excuse me, Tony. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'd mentioned the producer study that was provided. I think that was a joint study by all the producers. Will that be submitted for reimbursement, or has it been submitted for reimbursement? I think there was a $200 million study, something along those lines, if I remember correctly?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, the answer to your question is no, it will not, and no, it has not. And as I recall, it was $125 million. So it is not, we're not seeking reimbursement from the state for any costs that were incurred prior to the license, and those were incurred by Exxon and other parties prior to the license, just like TransCanada had costs incurred prior to the license. We're not seeking reimbursement under AGEA for those costs.
Hello. Thank you. But Mr. Palmer, Exxon became a member after the issuance of the license, and their expenses that they bring on and their part of their partnership, it is, I just want to be real clear that even though they came on after that, that you do not intend to ask for reimbursement for that $125 million study?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, that's correct. There will be no AGEA reimbursement for that $125 million study.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton, followed by Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Palmer, I'm curious about condition bids, and I know we've heard one condition is the only thing that we've ever heard talked about, I think, or that I've heard, and that is on tax rates. Can you give me, if large pipelines often have condition bids, can you give me some variety of those conditions that sometime accompany bids so that we have some better understanding?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, I will try to do so, although I do see some of my potential customers behind me. I don't want to give them new ideas. I know they're very sophisticated players and have lots of ideas already as to what those conditions will be, so I will attempt to address some. There's some fairly standard conditions that come in open seasons. Firstly, customers all often indicate that they want to ensure that we, the pipeline company, have all the regulatory approvals to conduct our business. That's a normal condition that comes in, and in fact, that's a condition, of course, that cannot be satisfied at the time where precedent agreements are concluded, because we will have a FERC filing in 2012 and, of course, hope to get an approval by 2014. But that's a relatively standard item. You will also see potential customers request that the pipeline company improve the offer in some fashion. Okay? Sometimes we can satisfy that, and sometimes we cannot. You see that we have indeed done that already, but you will sometimes see customers say, I would love to be a customer if you would provide this service for free. And I'm being glib with that. But you can see that customers often want you to improve the offer. That's a normal condition that would come forward. No disrespect meant to customers. I'd be strictly glib with how that comes about. That's a normal part of business. They may also indicate that they want to ensure that their commitment is subject to the pipeline company receiving sufficient volumes in total to make the project economic. So if, for example, you have 1 billion cubic feet a day and we're proposing a project to either Valdez or Alberta at 3 and 4.5, you don't want to be the sole customer for a 1 BCF a day pipeline to those locations because the economics change, of course. So that's a relatively standard condition precedent that we would see. You sometimes see customers that indicate they want service by a particular date, either a commitment that the company will be in service by a particular date or not before a particular date. That's also another standard condition that you see. That's probably as long a list as I should give you because I truly know that customers are very sophisticated and they already have many ideas as to what should be changed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Seaton and Representative Tuck, followed by Representative Johnson again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember last year that, and I believe the Denali pipeline, they had their FERC pre-file done about a year ago. And it was like a new type of FERC filing. It wasn't like a full FERC filing. How does your filing recently, last Friday, compare to the FERC filing that was done a year ago?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, you're exactly right. The FERC pre-filing that Denali completed, as well as we did a few months after Denali, was really very, very brief. It was a few pages of documentation in both cases. It really kicked off the process where FERC could assign staff to the project and really kick off the process. What we submitted on Friday was truly several hundred pages of documents, really six to eight inches of paper that comprehensively indicates what our capital costs are for the project, what our tariffs are, what our commercial terms are, what our terms and conditions are, the design work, engineering, all of that material is available now to the public as well as to FERC and will be used as we go forward in that open season. So the precedent agreements, the potential customer contracts that we have are actually in there. And as I described earlier, that's a unique process. Normally that would be shared not at this stage with the public, and it would be strictly between the pipeline company and potential customers. And when you had executed precedent agreements, then you'd file them with FERC.
Follow up,
Mr. Representative Tuck.
To meet the FERC requirements for the filing, is there anything more TransCanada needs to do?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we believe not. Clearly, that's a decision that we're hoping to receive a positive indication from FERC in 60 days, as I described earlier. But we think we've met all the conditions. Mr. Pike and his team have met with FERC staff a couple of times, and of course, that doesn't predispose a final decision. But we believe that we have satisfied all the conditions, and this will be approved by FERC in the 60 days. And if not, we'll work with FERC to resolve those conditions very, very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, and then David Gutenberg.
In discussions with other pipeline companies, they basically have two kinds of open seasons. They have a binding open season and then a conditional open season. Is this open season one that if producer A comes in and says, I want to bid my gas on condition 1, 2, and 3, if those conditions are met, they've obligated their gas? or is this a, I guess, conditional? I mean, it's kind of like an RFP as opposed to an RFQ, request for qualifications as opposed to firm, we will do this. I mean, if they meet the conditions that are they spell out, are they bound to ship their gas?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, this is a binding open season that we're conducting. And customers that commit their gas in this open season, if we resolve the precedent agreement, and I want to be clear with this, will take on significant obligations to share development costs with the pipeline company. But they preserve, as is the case in almost every major pipeline project, they preserve the right at final investment decision to withdraw from the project. Significant financial costs to them for doing so, and that's all laid out in those precedent agreements we filed, but that is the norm. It's not unusual in any way that several years in advance of the actual final investment decision, when we would hopefully have regulatory approvals for the project, that those customers will reserve unto themselves the right to withdraw at a significant financial penalty. But this is a binding precedent agreement that they are executing.
Mr. Follow-up, if I could.
Go ahead.
So from that, I would gather that when we get these conditions, they will be very specific. X tax rate for X number of years, et cetera, et cetera. If they're going to commit to these are the conditions, they will be binding. In just a few short months, we're going to have all the cards on the table.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, if you're discussing a potential condition with regards to upstream fiscal taxation, which is what I think you're addressing, I can't presuppose exactly what language a particular customer will use if that's one of their conditions. They may say satisfactory to them as opposed to a specific set of numbers. That's clearly in their hands, not in mine, as to how they draft their response to the pipeline company. Pipeline company is not, as you'll recall from the legislature request, in fact, some would say stronger than request, the pipeline company will not be engaged in those issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's much less binding than we say, because if their conditions are so vague, then that's not a terribly binding commitment for gas.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, there will be some conditions that we can resolve as a pipeline company with potential shippers, and I described some of those to Representative Seaton. There'll be some matters, if we take the potential item that you described, that we cannot resolve. And in that circumstance, yes, we will have to examine how we go forward. If there is a request that that issue be resolved, and if it is not resolved, then we have an obligation to continue. You'll recall under AGEA, we must continue for a FERC application, but we may or may not have binding obligations to customers if there's an outstanding item that we don't control.
So it's much less binding than, it's not truly a binding. I mean, I guess it's binding conditionally?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, you're describing a specific item. We are going through a binding open season. That's what we're doing. You've described a particular condition that a customer may indicate in response to that open season. If they do so, in the manner that you described, which is they want a fiscal structure satisfactory to them, and if that has not been resolved by the end of this year, then clearly that's not something the pipeline can resolve. And we will still be proceeding with the project, but that commercial breakthrough has not been achieved from our standpoint. But I'm not suggesting to you today that that's the only condition we're going to get in our initial open season. So that's why I'm being so reluctant to tell you that it's not a binding open season. In many cases, it will be a binding open season. In the particular case you describe, it may not be, depending on what the state and the producers have resolved on that issue.
We'll follow up.
Go ahead.
In your opinion, if we get a conditioned bid, hypothetically, that I think everyone probably recognizes we will see for some long-range tax concessions, fiscal certainty, and you do not have something you can take to the bank and finance with, failed open season, successful open season?
Representative Johnson through the chair, if that is the case at the end of the period that we've defined to resolve items, we have certainly not had a completely successful open season. We will have to determine whether or not it's a failed open season at the time, because if the state and the producers are within a short period of time of resolving it and have said so, then I'm not going to call it a failed open season. If, on the other hand, there has been no progress and there's no hope on the horizon, then perhaps it will be a failed open season.
Representative Johnson, then we'll go to...
And I hate to use the S word, but if it ends in May of 2010, what you're suggesting is that we're going to have to come back here for a special session to resolve that?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, our open season would conclude in July of this year, and it would be our expectation, if we receive condition bids, that it would take us through the end of this year to resolve conditions that we can control.
That's the best news I've heard in a while.
That we can control. You described a particular circumstance that we clearly cannot control. And in that circumstance, if that is a condition that's in front of us and we've resolved other items, then we're in the state's and producers' hands as to when or if that's ever resolved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just for the committees here, obviously we've hit on an issue that's of a lot of importance to the committee. I think we're going to go ahead and try and put together a program, go back again on an open season 101 type of thing, and get some people that actually put together and manage open seasons to come talk to us on these issues. We can ask them also their question. I think it'd be good for the community to do that. We've got Guttenberg, Olson, Wilson, and looks like Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always liked to see you, Mr. Palmer. Every time you come back, you have more balls in the air. You have conditional and commitments for shippers, and some of the commitments are conditional and some of them aren't. And I mean, you'll find that out at the end of the day. And your focus is always very tight, because we realize you have your both sides of your customers looking over your shoulder, waiting to see every word that you say. But in terms of the FERC filing, is it as black and white as you said it was, that they will either approve your filings or not? Or is that are they liable to come back with something themselves that is conditional on terms that have yet to be done?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, yes, a pleasure to see you as well, sir. And I do think it is relatively black and white, because as I described, this material that we filed, there are 21 conditions, and it's relatively procedural and straightforward. We're confident that we have met that. Perhaps they will come back and say that there's one that you need to change, but they're not commenting at this point on the quality of our commercial terms. They're not commenting on the quality of our capital estimate, even though we're confident we have high quality on both those fronts. We think it's primarily procedural, and we do think that we'll get approval in 60 days or shortly thereafter in order for us to conduct the open season on the schedule I described, May through July. I should just go on and indicate to you that when we make our FERC filing in 2012 for the certificate, that's when they will comprehensively review all items for not just the material, but all of the in-depth content that's behind it. And during that process, it is not unusual for them to come back with conditions that you must resolve in order to finally receive your certificate.
Mr. Chairman, just
go ahead, Representative Guttenberg.
Maybe it's appropriate. It seems like the process we're going through is always coming, maybe like a football analogy. It's always third and long, and there's always a fourth down, and you always, you know, if you're successful, you just start it over again. It's always started over again. And I think there's a lot of people out there waiting to play and hoping for your success, and others not. But recognizing that, you know, the competition is here looking over your shoulder, starting to read your filings, and my little little inkjet printer couldn't download the 700 pages to read it at home. I'm waiting to see what happened. And your interesting point on the what I've been trying to defend is your slippage on your projected open season coincides with the legislature's longer period of time to fulfill or approve the contract.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, yes, it was actually the administration and the legislature. We had hoped when we made the filing in the end of November of 2007 that the license would be issued in April. That was the basis of our schedule, and in order to file a schedule, we had to assume a start date. You'll probably recall that the administration, I think the recommendation came in May of 2008, and then the legislature took almost 2 months to review, and subsequent to that, there was not sufficient votes in the, I don't recall if it was the House or the Senate, but both, let's just say, to expedite that licensing process, so there was a lag of 90 days after that, and we finally received it in December. So the 100 business days is exactly the same as in our application. It just so happens now that it does run through the political time frame, but had nothing to do with our plan in any fashion.
And if I may, before we get to Representative Olson, we're on page 7 here, but I want to make sure we've only got 1 hour left here, and just in making sure we're managing our time appropriately to make sure that the public gets a chance to see this. This is their first time that they get to see this, and in a very, very brief explanation from Mr. Palmer on what all this means, the 7 to 8 inches thick of documents that all this means. So if we can do that, ask our questions, you know, precise, our answers precise, and make sure we get in there, because we got some really good stuff coming with costs and taxes and tariffs and oil comparison and stuff. With that said, to Representative Olson.
Welcome back, Mr. Palmer.
Thank you, Representative.
Doesn't seem like 18 months, but on a project of this magnitude and complexity, it's not unheard of to have two or three failed open seasons before the kinks are all worked out, isn't it?
Representative Olson, through the chair, you described circumstances that clearly can happen, yes, is that there, as you develop major projects, occasionally you do have to rewind more than once in order to succeed. I will tell you that the magnitude of work that has gone into this material that we filed at FERC is unusual at this stage. However, that doesn't mean that we will be successful. You've seen the initiatives that other parties have taken, and we applaud that. We've tried to do our best as well, but we'll go through the process. We're going to do so with a credible and competitive proposal and do our best to make it succeed. And we think that if other parties align and do the same, we will succeed. But clearly it takes two parties to make a success for this type of process, pipeline company and potential customers.
Follow up?
Go ahead, Representative Olson.
What would be the timeline on something like that? Let's say the first one is a failure because there are too many issues that can't be addressed. Would it be a year later or 6 months later? What's the formula for calculating how far in between?
Representative Olson, through the chair, you'll recall in AGEA we've obliged ourselves to go to the market every 2 years to obtain, to see if there's requirements for gas service. However, if I were to take the circumstance that Representative Johnson described to me earlier, in the event that we had been successful in resolving all other conditions between the pipeline company and its potential customers, excuse me, and the one outstanding item were fiscal issues, and those were not resolved by year end this year or so. However, if subsequent to that, I'll just pick a date out of the air, if 6 months later the state of Alaska and potential customers had resolved that issue to the satisfaction of both and were ready to go and were knocking on our door, clearly, as a pipeline company, we're going to be very keen to receive them warmly. And so we don't have to wait 2 years. We could do so expeditiously and hold another open season very quickly, because we will be advancing the project as we're obliged to under AGEA, and would do so expeditiously, I can assure you.
ultimately, I think the 900-pound gorilla that's sitting on everybody in this building is the fiscal terms.
Representative Olson, through the chair, as I've described earlier, that's clearly an issue that potential customers have indicated publicly that they need resolution. They certainly have not described to us in what fashion, and that's something between the sovereign, the state, and those producers.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, you mentioned earlier that there was, one of the producers had entered the and gave a bid in the open season, but for some reason pulled out, that there would be, I don't know if you use this word, but I'm just saying this word, that there would be a penalty. Now, for us, that, you know, how strong is that? I mean, you know, I realize that you just keep doing until you can kind of work out some kind of agreement, and I understand that. But if somebody just throws up their hands and say, we're pulling out, but they have really made a commitment, how serious is that then, as far as financially or what happens?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, let me take the circumstance where a customer did commit in the initial open season, did get to an executed precedent agreement with the pipeline company, so it resolved things, and then decided at final investment decision 2014 that the world has changed for them or for natural gas prices or whatever, and they wanted to withdraw. They would be obliged in that circumstance under our precedent agreement that we filed to reimburse us for the full development cost of the project. So that is a significant financial commitment that they are making when they execute that precedent agreement. And as you might imagine, if we were to withdraw, there's a sharing mechanism. So when I say that this is a binding precedent agreement, it truly is that. If parties execute the precedent agreement, they are making a significant financial commitment, just as we are, just as the state has.
Representative Seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we're going to have an open season 101, we can wait, but I would like to put on the table that what I would like to do is get some relationship between the benefits of initial bidding at the initial open season. There are some things that we're laying there. And if how conditional bids have to be, or at what point do those advantages of bidding in the initial open season get withdrawn from parties. And so we can wait until the 101, but I just wanted to make sure that we cover that as well. Thank you.
Whatever we need to do. Thank you. Are we ready to move on? Representative Olson.
Would you like to run the meeting till 3:30?
That would probably be good.
I can certainly push mine back.
Okay. So we'll be here until 3:30. Mr. Palmer, so we'll try and regulate the meeting and try and time it on through that. Go ahead, Tony. Thank you, Representative Olson, for moving my bill back on the comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll proceed to slide 8. And just to address an item in reference to what Representative Seaton just described, we are offering better commercial terms and access than in the AGIA applications I described on Friday. That benefit is about $500 million. And let me just walk through the additional per year. Let me just walk through those items. These are available to shippers that commit in that initial open season. So a bit like you going into a supermarket or a department store, we're offering you a discount if you commit this summer. That's exactly what we're doing. We understand that we're facing a highly competitive environment, not just to move Alaska gas to market, but other sources of gas that are competing both in the lower 48 and in global markets. We have recognized that, and we have moved to compete. So let me just walk through that. We have comprehensive Alberta and Valdez options. Those are responsive to shipper discussions. We've had shipper discussions now for many months. Potential customers at Valdez requested a 48-inch 3 BCF a day pipeline. That's what we've provided in our application. They requested access to other pipelines upstream of the Alberta Hub. Rather than strictly going into TransCanada's system at the Alberta Hub, which I will tell you I believe that customers will want to do, they will now have the option to not go into the Alberta Hub. They can come off the pipeline upstream of our Alberta Hub and sell it into other markets through existing infrastructure if they so choose. Now, I will tell you, the Alberta Hub is a highly liquid market, and I think that it has inherent advantages, but that will be a customer decision. You'll also likely recall that we had a 25-year minimum contract term in our AGIA application. We have now reduced that to 20. So if a customer wants 20 years or 21 or 22, right up through 35, they can do so. But prior to this material we filed, 25 years was a minimum. That shifts risk onto the pipeline company. We've also offered interruptible, overrun, and park and loan services. Those are short-term services to potential customers, either that for service within Alaska or to service downstream for customers. That also is an enhancement. And as I described earlier in response to Representative Wilson, we've shared development costs in circumstances where we terminate, not where the customer terminates. And lastly, I will highlight the better commercial terms by $500 million a year. And let me put that into some context for you. Recall that the state's total financial commitment under AGIA is $500 million. These better commercial terms reduce the tolls by $500 million per year over a 25-year life. And we've done that by reducing the return on equity from our application down to 12%. We've secondly indicated that through depreciation we will only recover 80% of our initial capital through those initial contract terms. So if a customer takes 20 years or 25 years, we will only depreciate the pipeline by 80% in that term.
While you're going through those, Tony, do us a favor, because I'm trying to roll back in my memory. Instead of 12.5% return on equity, can you give us what it was and what it is now so that we have an understanding of what that means?
Right.
Those are big numbers that were...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will do that. Is in our AGIA application, we provided a formulaic approach for the return on equity. And when we made our application, we expected that return on that formula would yield a 14% return on equity, 14.0. And you can see that our proposal now is 12.0. So that's for customers that commit in this initial open season only. And, of course, for capital recovery, we had anticipated recovering 100% of the capital over the initial contract term. So if a customer had taken a 25-year contract, we would have recovered through depreciation 100% of that capital. Now we will only be recovering 80%. Clearly shifting risk away from customers to the pipeline sponsors. And lastly, you'll recall, I expect that for expansions, we had indicated that expansions should be funded with 60% debt and 40% equity, and now we're proposing 30% equity. And for citizens that are not familiar with this terminology, equity yields a higher cost for customers than debt, and of course, higher income taxes. So anytime you reduce the amount of equity, that's to the benefit of customers and to the benefit of Alaskans, to the detriment of the pipeline owner. So that's risk that we're taking on as a company, both companies, ExxonMobil and TransCanada.
Competition is a good thing. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the life of the pipeline anticipated to be, Mr. Paul?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, that's a highly complex question, as I expect you well understand. It depends on whether you're describing physical life or economic life. Let me try to be responsive to both.
Let me just qualify the question. What happens after 20 years?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I'm going to give you a that depends answer. Physically, this pipeline will last for many, many decades. We have pipelines in service for 50 years. And certain ones in the lower 48 that are 60 years old. So physically, this pipeline will last well beyond 20 years. In the event that there is no more gas after 20 years, the pipeline will be retired. Okay? It will be retired at that point, and we will not have earned as much money as we had hoped because there's no contract extensions. In the event that there is lots more gas in Alaska, and you won't be surprised to hear that we're very hopeful that that is the case, then we would expect to either obtain new contracts or extensions of these contracts, in which case we will have the opportunity to earn our 12% return, not a discounted amount.
Representative Johnson, follow-up.
I'm less concerned about your 12% as I would be your 20%. If you have to start negotiating terms again from a pipeline that's already built, you sort of kind of have all the cards. So I'm not sure you're mitigating risk as much as you're shifting risk into year 21. At that point, you will be the only game in town. You will be able to pretty much write your own ticket. If it's 12, 14, 15, 20%, you'd be able to do your own. You'll be in control of the math at that point. Will there be an option for in this, do you expect, I guess, maybe conditional uses that say 12.5% now with, in the future, will maintain the same?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, you're going to exactly what I would expect a sophisticated customer to do. The 12.0% return on equity, these terms that we're offering are actually available to customers for a renewal period as well. So exactly what you've described, we've already contemplated and is available to customers for a renewal period as well.
Thank you. For the sake of the committee's staff's passed us a note here that they're going to be available over to Wednesday if we do need you to come back and answer questions from the committee. So, and that's a good thing, too, because we have a little bit of time to look at their presentation, chew on it, ask questions. We're only going to be smarter because of it also. Thank you, Mr. Palmer and your staff for doing this.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Johnson. We got lots of time now.
Now that we have extra time, I want to go back to what is taking on more risk about being able to recover it on the backside than the front side. To me, that's just, and I used it, I think, this morning in press availability, it's like when you buy furniture from a local furniture store and they say no payments until 2012. Anyone who thinks they're not making those payments and still having the interest accrued is kidding themselves. Is that really what we're doing here, is we're just shifting the risk to the back end and your return on investment to the back end, so you're really not deferring any risk unless there's no gas in 20 years? Then I would agree with you. But if there is gas, which we all believe there is, are you really just not shifting the risk, not mitigating the risk?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, this is not at all like the circumstance you describe at the furniture store. As we sit here today, 10 years before in service and 20 years later, there is huge risk as to whether or not the gas will be available, the project will be economic. And as you know, have we completed the capital cost with a reasonable amount of credibility? Because if we have not, the customers will have to pay the cost for that 20 years. But if we've got very high costs, then it's unlikely to be competitive and they're unlikely to renew it. So it's exactly the opposite of what you describe. We are taking on that risk, and I believe you will find that customers will look at that as a very attractive option that we've put forward. And I would be pleased to be on the other side of this circumstance where customers are taking on this risk, which is what our original proposal was. The world is a highly uncertain place, and 30 years out in time may be quite different than we are today. Certainly, we've seen the world change in the last couple of years. I would expect it to continue to change going forward. 35 years ago, the price of gas in the lower 48 was 44 cents an MMBTU. So, do I think we're taking on a lot of risk? Yes, I do.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. By the same token, I think the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was how much? So we're really, it's all relative in terms of past. Anyway, what happens at the end? You recover 80% of your capital 20 years, there's no gas. What does that do to your company?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, our company will have received a lower return than 12% on this money. That's what it does to our company. both companies and any other sponsor that joins us. We will have repaid the debt to the bankers, because I'm sure they're going to require that, and we will have received a much lower return than 12%.
I think that the bottom line on this is, if I remember Aegea going back a year plus two here in this discussion, there's several off-ramps, too, for TransCanada, Alaska, on this, too, for off-ramps, you know, if their board doesn't approve of the final plans. That's just standard business deals that they do, and so everybody's going to have to come out. We're all going to have to work to make this happen together, as he stated earlier. That's it.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I did want to be clear. If the project goes in service, as I described here, that will be our risk. The sponsors of this project will take that risk that in 20 years' time there is additional gas and there will be customers that will enable us to earn this 12% return. Otherwise, we will not do so. With your indulgence, I'll move to the next slide. Slide 9. There are two pipeline options. I'll go through this quickly because I think the committee members know this quite well. 4.5 BCF a day, approximately 1,700 miles. You'll recall perhaps from 18 months ago, we had 1,715 miles. We've refined it now down to 1,700, so we've saved 15 miles as a result of significant engineering work. That gas will be delivered to pipeline systems. Once you get into the Alberta hub, you can go to that grid, which will allow you to serve customers from Boston, New York, through the Midwest, all the way to the West Coast. I'll spend no time on that. I think you know that very well. Option 2, a pipeline from North Slope to Valdez, once again, as requested by customers, 3 BCF a day. It's about 800 miles, 48-inch line, converted to LNG in a facility to be built by others. We described that our application would not provide for a liquefaction facility at Valdez. The potential customers are very sophisticated players, be they either major producers or other downstream players. They're fully capable of funding and doing that themselves. And that gas would move on to either U.S. markets or international markets. Both options include an opportunity for Alaska communities to acquire natural gas from the pipeline. There'll be a minimum of 5 offtakes in Alaska. We'll describe more of that on Thursday in Anchorage at this technical conference. There'll be a world-class, huge natural gas treatment plant to be located at Prudhoe Bay, adjacent to the existing facilities, primarily to remove CO2 and other impurities. That will be one of the largest facilities of its kind. And in fact, because that facility will likely be built in modules and barged in and then put together up in that slope, there are short weather windows that you're probably more familiar with than I am to deliver facilities into the dock up there. And there'll be an approximately 58-mile transmission line connecting Point Thompson Field to the plant. So parties that have gas at Point Thompson will, we would expect, would nominate gas for that. And of course, if your gas is only at Prudhoe, that's a piece of pipe that you would not be using. I tried to go through that quickly, Mr. Chairman.
You did a good job, Tony. When you talk about the tremendous amount of expenditures, gas treatment plants, pipe, you know, establishing of man camps, all this is going to be happening, I would assume that after the end of the open season, when the state starts getting into their 90% share, that $100 million would be, or $500 million would be eaten up way before we'd even get to some of that stuff. Or does it include engineering, pre-engineering, and those types of expenditures on that?
Mr. Chairman, there's no question that it is our estimate that the $500 million will be, you will hit the cap before we're finished spending money on the development stage. That's our expectation. I wish that were not the case, but that's my expectation, is that your $500 million will be capped and the sponsors will continue to spend money to get the final investment decision. That's my expectation.
Is there a way that we could try and get, I'm sure your people have worked it out, you know, expenditures on costs? You know, you've got cost guesstimates because you really just don't know. And reimbursements from the state, where those meet together and at what time. That'd be pretty interesting, I think, for the community to look at, if we could.
Mr. Chairman, I think as Commissioner Galvin described, you will see some of that in the reimbursement document that they filed last Friday, as I recall.
He's nodding his head, yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll turn to slide 10. This deals with the project cost estimates and indicative toll. This page deals with the project to Alberta, and the next page addresses the project to Valdez. The capital cost range, and I will tell you that all of these numbers on this page are in $2,009 dollars. Capital cost range is $32 to $41 billion. Target in service for the project is 2020. As I described to you earlier, the gas treatment plant is the time critical component of this project. So that those sea lifts are what are determining the ultimate in service date for this project, not the pipeline. At this point, it's the gas treatment plant. The tariff range, including fuel, to get to the Alberta hub is $2.80 to $3.50. It is the norm at this early stage of a project to provide a range. We have done so. That does not mean, as some parties have indicated, that we're at the top of that range. This is a range intended to be that we will be within that range. And I provided for reference for parties what the Alberta hub gas price is as forecasted by the U.S. Department of Energy in December of 2009. In their annual energy outlook. You can see that that's 6.25 to 7.65 for the years 2020 to 2030, and in fact, I have a slide on that coming up, but I wanted to provide you the most current forecast by the U.S. government. And you'll see if you deduct the tariff from that Alberta hub gas price, you'll get about a $3 to $4 per MMBTU margin. That would be a netback. Basically the market price less the cost of transportation. We believe that that makes the project both technically and commercially viable, but it's up to the customers, clearly, in 6 months' time to decide if that's acceptable margin to them. And from that $3 or $4, they would have to pay their own costs as well as take their profits and share with governments through the tax system.
Thank you, Tony. We had questions by Representative Olson and Johnson.
18 months ago, the estimated price was $24 to $28 billion, I believe, roughly. Is that correct?
Representative Olson, through the chair, 18 months ago, the cost was $26 billion in 2007 dollars. And if you'd like me to describe a little bit how the costs increased, because I think that's probably the underlying issue behind your question.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out where the $13 billion, if we take the top end of both.
Sure. Let me try to address that for you. Firstly, between 2007 and 2009, the cost of oil and gas projects went up. There was inflation in our industry. You probably won't be surprised to hear that. You also won't be surprised to hear, certainly you've experienced this if you've traveled, that the U.S. dollar has deflated relative to other foreign currencies, including the Canadian dollar. Since all these numbers are cited in U.S. dollars, when the U.S. dollar goes down in value, that causes costs in when you purchase products from other countries or, quite frankly, construct the component in Canada, where the majority of the costs that we will spend will be in Canadian dollars. When you convert it to U.S. dollars, costs are higher. So that's the first component that you should focus on. Secondly, you should focus on the fact that when TransCanada made our filing, included the $26 billion, we said that we did not plan to build a gas treatment plant. Although required, we did supply a conceptual cost estimate. I will tell you that that was based on a two sea lift season. After bringing in an experienced partner in the gas treatment plant, we learned that that was inaccurate. Three sea lifts will be required, and there's a very significant increase in the gas treatment plant in these costs. There's also a modest other cost increase in the pipeline, but I've described for you where the bulk of the changes are. Is you move from 2007 dollars to 2009, and the gas treatment plant went up very significantly in cost.
So $41 billion, we're going to be getting a Mercedes, not a Toyota?
Representative Olson, through the chair, I'm not sure that would have been a good analogy 10 days ago, but today it perhaps is. You'll be getting a very high-quality system, both the gas treatment plant as well as the pipeline.
That's the answer I was looking for. Thanks.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tony, on your open season plan, it's a 20-year minimum contract, but this, your tariff and et cetera is based upon a 25-year. Can you tell me what the tariff would be if everyone bites on a 20-year plan?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, if you give me a moment, yes, I think I can. Representative Johnson, through the chair, and I'm having to do some of these calculations in my head, I think that the tariffs will be approximately 15 to 20 cents higher than these numbers if it's a 20-year contract rather than a 25-year contract. Because, as you might understand, we're recovering 80% of the capital over 20 years rather than 25. That means that tariffs are slightly higher. So that's in the order of magnitude. I've done that in my head, Mr. Johnson. Right.
And I also have a question about Point Thompson. Do you have any expectation that this pipeline can be built without the gas that's at Point Thompson?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, the pipeline company seeks to have available to it all possible gas. You won't be surprised to hear, be that from Prudhoe Bay or Point Thompson or other existing fields or to be found fields. That's our goal as a pipeline company. But we are not in the position of stipulating how much or whether gas will be available from any particular field. That's the responsibility of producers, the state, and the AOGCC. And certainly, the numbers you've seen here are calculated based on 4.5 BCF a day of initial capacity and 4.5 BCF a day for the full 25 years, Representative Johnson. So not our decision on that front. Our calculations are based on 4.5 BCF a day being available throughout that 25-year period and 20 years in the circumstance that I described to you earlier.
Follow up, Mr.
Follow up.
In your asterisk under Prudhoe Bay, Alberta, it says adds 15 to 20% for the Point Thompson line. Are you talking about the line from Point Thompson to the pump station one, or the equivalent of what it will be under a gas scenario?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, yes. If you have Point Thompson gas, you should add 15 to 20 cents to the numbers I cited here. So if you're moving from Point Thompson to the Alberta hub, your numbers would be $2.95 to $3.70 because you have an extra 58 miles to transport your gas, as opposed to the Prudhoe Bay customers that are coming on at Prudhoe Bay.
Are you there?
I think I have some questions about why the Point Thompson line's in the open season.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, you'll likely recall, as we came together.
Probably not.
As we came together with ExxonMobil last summer, we indicated that there will be no reimbursement from the state's AGIA fund for the Point Thompson line because we did not include that in our application. So there's no reimbursement by the state. However, we know that there may be gas available from Point Thompson, and we want to attract that gas. So in the open season, we are offering service for that piece of pipe for customers that have gas at Point Thompson. They don't have to take it, and you will not be reimbursing any monies for it.
Well, Representative Johnson, then Olson, and then...
Is there a number for tariff for gas from Prudhoe Bay line to this line for ConocoPhillips, British Petroleum's, or any of the other producers? I mean, are we going to be ask at some point to add tariff onto the lines that from the other fields that come into this gas pipeline?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, in the event that other customers have gas outside of Prudhoe Bay and outside of Point Thompson, and you can see that we've provided for here, they will have an alternative. They can do what often happens is they will build a line to Prudhoe Bay, pay for it themselves. The other alternative is, if they wished, is they could come to the project and say, I have gas 25 miles away and I would like you to provide that service. And in that circumstance, we'd certainly be prepared to consider it. I'm not giving you an answer to that today, but I'd certainly be prepared to consider to build that line for them, and they would then pay a tariff. And only the parties that have gas at that field would find that attractive, not other parties.
Mr. Chairman, is the 15 to 20% additional tariff that everyone has to pay, or is it just the line, just what is paid from Point Thompson to the open line?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I'm sorry I wasn't clear. Is only customers moving gas from Point Thompson through that 58-mile pipeline to Prudhoe Bay will pay that 15 to 20 cents. Okay. In the event that you have gas at Prudhoe Bay, you would not pay that 15 to 20 cents. If, on the other hand, you do have gas at Point Thompson, and we build exactly what we expect here, it's a 58-mile pipeline to move 1.1 BCF a day, you would have to pay the tariffs that I've cited here, 280 to 350, plus the 15 or 20 cents to move your gas from Point Thompson over to Prudhoe Bay.
Okay.
All the partners have gas at Point Thompson. I think Conoco has gas at Point Thompson. BP has gas, or they have leases there as well. I think they're partners in that, as well as 50 or so other people. Is that not accurate?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I know of the parties you cited. In fact, as I recall, and I'm going from recollection, ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Conoco are players, and I understand that there are others. If they choose to nominate gas from Point Thompson Field and they want to move it over to Prudhoe Bay to enter this major system, they will have to pay the 15 to 20 cents. If, on the other hand, they don't wish or are not able to nominate Point Thompson gas, they will not pay the 15 to 20 cents.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, if I, and I'll be done, I'm probably more confused than I should be. Is TransCanada going to build the line between Point Thompson and Pump Station 1?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, yes, if customers nominate it, bid for it in the open season and request it. If they do not, of course, we wouldn't have any customers and we wouldn't build it.
Well, and one more. Is part of your partnership with Exxon that you build the line because they are the driver here?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, our proposal, the Alaska Pipeline Project proposal, is offering service on that piece of pipe from Point Thompson Field over to Pump Station 1, over to gas treatment plant. Yes, we're offering to do that. And we're offering to do that. The two sponsor companies have asked the Alaska Pipeline Project to offer that service, not just to Exxon, but to all parties that have gas in the field.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We got Representative Olson.
I've got a simple one. Will we have a decision out of AOGCC on what we can actually take out of Point Thompson by the time we have the open season?
Representative Olson, through the chair, I suspect you have a better answer to that than I do.
I'm clueless.
Representative Olson, I certainly don't have the answer to your question. I mean, that's a question you should pose to AOGCC. I have no insider information as to how they will make and when they will make that decision. That's not something a pipeline would normally be involved with. We're certainly interested as to how and when they will do that, but it's not our party to decide how that will be determined or when.
Follow?
Yeah, I
wasn't sure if there was a timeline on AOGCC for that decision, but
Representative Olson,
I see Commissioner Galvin shaking his head no on that one. I think that's his best guess, but he's not testifying, so we don't have him on record on that.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, my question kind of tags along with his. If they say that at Point Thompson, I'm talking about right now, let's say that they've got oil, they found oil, and they're getting some of it out of there, but they still need the gas. Can they apply for open season and say, we don't think we can do it until 2022, knowing that it's going to start maybe 2020, can deals be made when somebody comes in later, or is that, do they have to wait for the 2 years when everybody can do another open season or something?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the answer to your question is generally yes. They could come up with that type of structure. It will have an impact on the structure of the tolls, unless they have 4.5 BCF a day of gas, or we together have 4.5 BCF a day from other locations that could fill the pipe prior to Point Thompson becoming available. And that's clearly something that producers know, and the sovereign knows much better than I do, the pipeline company. So that could occur. Or they may say that I don't have 4.5 BCF a day, but I have 3.5 for 2 years and then 4.5. In that circumstance, we'd have to recalculate these tariffs.
Thank you. Tony, I've been waiting to see if this question came up, because there is two ratios that, you know, are two things that we have to look at when we're looking at gas and those volumes is the volume of gas and the quality of gas, the BTU value of that gas. And those affect the economics. And that's, again, where Representative Johnson might have been trying to get in there too, is the development of Point Thompson, the natural gas liquids that could be available, what's available in Prudhoe Bay right now. You know, obviously a very wet gas is compared to Gubik type gas. And so when you look at those different BTU ratio values of that gas, we know you can only stick just so many cubic feet down a piece of pipe, but the value of that gas down there, that's going to be probably the most pertinent part of when you're coming up to your costs here. And again, when you're looking at need downstream, you know, or where we're shipping our gas to, or desire from the people to purchase our gas, is the BTU value of that, if whether they want to or not. When we're looking at your estimates on comparisons between oil and gas, and I cheated and I snuck ahead up to page 12, where we're looking at $110 to $125 barrel in oil, you know, and as we go along, and maybe it's best to just explain that as you go along, and maybe to chew on it a little bit while we're doing that. When we're looking at this, when we want to make sure that there's a commercially viable project, three words in here that you've got in here, I think it's probably more important than anything, but that won't happen unless we're making sure we're looking at the value of that product, where it's going, and who's buying it, based on other alternative energy options, oil. So if it's $125 oil, is that what it's going to take? It's a big question, but that is the question.
Mr. Chairman, I will deal with this in more detail when I get to the slide on Valdez option, but I do want to highlight for you that these tariffs are based on the liquids contents in the gas after discussions with the field operators, and we're very pleased the field operators have been very open in having a discussion with the potential pipeline sponsors to what that expectation is. But as you've heard me say for a couple of years now, it is the customer's decision as to where those liquids are removed, and the customer will make that determination. The pipeline, as you describe, can move a certain volume in terms of how many MCF that we can move on a particular day. The customers will decide where those liquids are removed, and if the liquids are removed at a particular location, that will have an impact on the toll, because the tolls here are in heating content, million BDUs a day. So you're exactly right, and I'll address the issue of oil prices shortly when I move to the next slides.
Yeah, thank you, Don. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at option one, option two, pipeline from Alaska's North Slope to Alberta, and then North Slope to Valdez. And we have an open season coming up, so potentially if there's a demand for Alaska's gas, we can have two routes in competition just with the two proposals that you have. I think on page two it shows two different maps. And when I first looked at it, I thought there was one that was just being branched off for another one, but we're talking about two individual lines depending on how the open season behaves. Is there a chance that Trans-Alaska Pipeline would be building a pipe to Alberta in addition to one going to Valdez, or is it just one or the other?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, and very good question is, you'll see that our what we've defined here is a proposal for 4.5 billion cubic feet a day to Alberta and 3 billion cubic feet a day to Valdez. We do not believe that there's 7.5 billion cubic feet a day of gas to be committed at the end of this open season to allow both pipes to be constructed immediately. We just don't feel that's the case, and we haven't heard that from any potential customers. So we do think it's an either or. Now, in the event that one alternative succeeds now and is moving forward, there's always potential to expand that option or potentially to have, in effect, a Y line in the future to go the other route. But at the moment, what we have to succeed with is to get one of the alternatives over the finish line so that we have a volume that works to either Valdez or to Alberta so that we have a pipeline in service, and that can draw on more exploration in the future and hopefully draw additional gas that might allow both markets to be served in the future. On the other hand, you may just simply see an expansion of the original pipe to that original destination.
Okay. Mr. Chair, follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. But that was a 3 billion cubic feet per day standalone going to Valdez. What if you were at a demand, a customer demand of, let's say, a total of 5.5 billion cubic feet, and you branched off there going to Valdez with the only 1 billion cubic feet going the rest of the way? Is that a potential option, or would that be out of the question?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we're always willing to look at an option. That's a good option where you have 5.5 billion cubic feet going to market. You would see different tolls, of course, than what we've described here for both alternatives. But we would certainly, that would be a happy outcome if we had a very large volume of gas committed to make a project work, and if customers were willing to commit gas to both locations on those volumes, we as a pipeline company would always want to look at that. I will reserve judgment until I see the final numbers and what the commitments are.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Tony.
Tony, I'm going to just ask your opinion on this because I'm trying to manage time if you're going to be coming back on Wednesday, because the cost of oil, the cost of gas, throughput, all of that is really critical to whether it's economically viable projects, where they are. Would that be better off covered in a Wednesday session, and maybe spend a little bit more time on how open seasons work now, or how that's going to work, what you expect to submit to FERC, what engineering reports, environmental reports? There's a lot of stuff out there, but I'm just wondering how.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if, or the committee if, members, if your intention you is to break, I wonder if I could do one more slide, which is really the gas price forecasts that relate to this option. And if you wish, I can come back and do the Valdez option on Wednesday, if that's your preference.
Let's go ahead and at least try and get through that part. Does that look good for the community members?
I have a question after that.
Go ahead.
This is a simple slide that I just thought I would include for parties to illustrate for them how gas price forecasts have changed since we made our AGIA filing. And in fact, although hard to see here, you'll see the darkest line. It's called AEO 2007 in December 2006.
Could you explain that?
Yes. The U.S. Department of Energy produces an annual energy outlook, AEO, every year in December. And so when we made our filing in November of 2007, the most recent U.S. Department of Energy forecast we had was this darkest line. I can't tell if it's black or dark brown, but the darkest line is the set of numbers that we had at the time. And in $2009, you can see that 2020, the gas price forecast was about $5.75, and by 2030, it was up to about $6.60. Then you'll see the next line, which is the forecast that was completed in December of 07, they call it an AEO 2008. You see that line is a bluish line, slightly higher, not significantly higher. Then if you move to the forecast that they did in April, and the reason that it's in April is because they have indicated the forecast they actually did in December of 2008, they don't put a lot of credence to. So they provided an update, highly unusual because of the volatility in supply in the U.S. They did that green line in April of 2009, and you see that that is significantly higher. In fact, to give you those numbers, in 2020, that's like $7.20, and by 2030, they were up to $8.60. Then they completed their most recent study in December of 2009. That's the red line with the dots on it. You'll see that that forecast has 2020 starts at about 6.25, and by 2030, you're up to about $7.65. So down from where it was early in 2009, which was driven off a high oil price forecast, but still higher, in fact, than the forecast that we included in our application under AGEA. And in fact, on an average basis over that 10-year period, it's about 60 cents per MMBTU higher. So that's to the benefit. That helps the viability of the project. And that is their most recent forecast by the U.S. Department of Energy. I will tell you that's in the ballpark of what a lot of other forecasts have used, but I wanted to be consistent with what I've shown you in the past.
So I think when we look at this, it's what we've all been talking about for the last couple of years is nobody really has been able to get a good accurate on the price of energy.
And Mr. Chairman, as you followed it, and I know you follow it very closely, and I know committee members do as well, unfortunately, natural gas prices are one of the most, if not the most volatile commodity in terms of prices. They actually fluctuate more so even than oil. And we all know how difficult it is to forecast oil prices, which is why I've stated, and we've clearly stated on the previous slide, it's our view as a pipeline sponsor that it is viable, but it will be up to the customers to decide their own views in that initial open season. Are they prepared to take that risk? Because it will be their risk as to what the ultimate commodity price of the gas will be delivered in the marketplace.
Well, you really hit the nail on the head there, you know, when we're looking at that. And I know that we've talked, and I know that my co-chair and I talk about it on a regular basis, but looking at these different prices and trying to figure out where we can be to get that best spot, because ultimately what we do here at the state level is going to depend on feedstock costs into this, or fuel that's shipped down through there, and whether that's viable for the producers to produce, and we'll continue on with those discussions. When we're looking at these graphs, like on page 11 here, is there any way to try and look at these or try and put a hedge on this? You know, because investment capital groups, or people who are interested in spending this kind of money, that's a lot of money, you know. Again, as you said many times, the biggest pipeline project in the world. What do they generally expect for a return on equities on this, and does that affect that because the risk is so high?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly don't profess to be an expert in this area, and I will not give you a forecast as to what expected return producers may need. You probably won't be surprised to hear, since I'm not a producer. That's their prerogative to respond to you on that front. But I will tell you, with regards to the ability to hedge, my understanding, and I would say that I'm slightly above a layman, but certainly not an expert, is that it is very difficult to hedge beyond 5 years out for any significant volume. So if you look at this project, parties that would be committing, we hope this year, they would be committing into a gas price forecast commencing in 2020 and thereafter for an additional 20 or 30 years. I don't think that they can realistically hedge that risk this year. I don't believe that they can do that in any realistic fashion for the magnitude of this gas. So I think that will be what most parties would consider an open risk for them, but if you had a producer in front of you, they may be able to give you a more accurate answer than I can.
Well, no, I think that, I don't know, I certainly don't, I'm not an economist, and you know more about it than I do, this is your business, but I think that you hit the nail on the head of word of us, a lot of us are concerned, is because the difficulty of trying to do that more than 5 years out is the assurances of trying to make sure that that's there. And trying to make sure that they're within that hedge. And I think that's where the state's part is, and that's kind of where, after 5 years, I've learned to try and estimate or try and guess what the answer is going to be before you ask it. And that's, you know, obviously, I think, probably a real big concern for the majority of the legislators sitting here, you know, where we're doing that, how do we make sure that we're within that range?
And Mr. Chairman, I do believe that once you're near in service, certainly for the first few years of operation, if we were in 2019 and going into service in 2020, I think that the customers could, if they wish, hedge early years of the project, assuming that markets in 10 years' time were just like they are now. But once again, they would still have a significant open number of years. They couldn't do 20 years. They would still likely be in a circumstance where they could do a few years if they so chose to do so.
Take their best guess. Make their best guess. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, I know through all of this, I'm just thinking, you know, everybody's working in the world is working on a different type of energy, an alternative energy or something, and I mean, that's really a risk when you think about it, because in the next 10 years there could be another energy source that would pop up that would just mess up a lot of people.
Or help a lot of laughter.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I think you've identified another very significant risk. Now, I will tell you that the Department of Energy, as they do this forecast, do try to account for that. However, you're exactly right. I mean, the world is an uncertain place, particularly 10 and 30 years out in time, and parties that are committing to this, ourselves, the state, producers, and others, are taking on significant risk. That's the nature of the business, is it? When you're making a commitment for a long-lived asset that will go in service 10 years from now, there is a huge amount of risk for us all. The flip side of it is, if you take the numbers that I described for you here, in the event that our forecast costs turned out to be exactly as we described, and if these gas prices turned out to be exactly as the U.S. Department of Energy describes, there would be $3 to $4 margin. If you take that times 25 years, that's in the order of $120 to $150 billion of value after you've paid for the transportation costs over 25 years. So yes, there's huge risk, but there's also a potential reward, and customers will do what they always do, which is they will judge whether or not there's a fair balance for them, just like we have to, and you do, I'm sure, as the state as well.
Representative Wilson.
Just one more question. In the United States has their energy outlook. Does Canada have their energy outlook? And are they basically the same, or are they totally different? Or?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, Canadian government also has a forecast. And, of course, many different consultants do that on a proprietary basis to their clients. I will honestly tell you I have not looked at the most recent Canadian forecast, but I have looked at the U.S. Department of Energy relative to a number of other sophisticated consultants, and that red line for the most recent forecast is in the range of a lot of forecasts. That doesn't mean that there aren't outliers. There definitely are, but that's not a projection of gas prices that's out of line with a lot of other consultants. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's correct. A lot of folks are sometimes together in their correctness or inaccuracy.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I used to do that for a living many years ago, so I have to be careful what I say.
He's having more fun now. Representative Guttenberg, again, for the committee's information and members of the public, specifically members of the public, we are presently adding a link onto the committee's webpage right now to TransCanada's filing, and we will have those packets in your offices as soon as they're available. Representative Guttenberg.
Give us a chair. Talk for a minute about the Mackenzie route. We hear different things from the Canadian side of this equation. It's on, it's off, it's got to come first. What's your perspective on what's going on?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. You've touched on another subject that I will be careful how I respond. I've described to this committee before that certainly TransCanada's belief, and we think ExxonMobil's as well, that both projects are not restricted by lack of demand. So it's not a lack of demand issue for either project that's going to restrict them from meeting the market. The flip side is there's no guaranteed market for either one of those pipelines accept local usage. They will have to compete in the marketplace just like other sources of gas. And they will compete effectively on price. That's effectively what you do, because natural gas is such a fungible commodity that when you deliver it into the marketplace, your gas and Mackenzie gas and Rocky Mountain gas and shale gas all looks the same, burns the same. It's no different. So it is the price delivered in the marketplace where you will compete. And since there's a highly liquid market throughout North America, once you're into major hubs like Alberta or a lower 48, you must compete effectively on cost. Can you be competitive on cost at the market price that's established, since you won't drive that price? It's my view that both Mackenzie and Alaska will go forward based on regulatory and commercial breakthroughs for each project. They are on totally independent tracks. They are not linked. They can both succeed, they can both fail, or one can succeed and the other can fail, based on how they do on those regulatory and commercial breakthroughs. I've described for you the ones that I think are needed on this project, and I'll continue to do that on Wednesday, since it doesn't look like we'll finish today. The Mackenzie project is at a different stage than this project today. I will tell you that their application, they're not going through Canada under the Northern Pipeline Act like we are, because that's specific to our project for the Alaska gas project. It's not available to any other party, and certainly not available to any other project. They made an application to the National Energy Board in October of 2004. They had all their customers in hand at the time. So we're talking about going to an open season. They had all their customers in hand in 2003. What they didn't have is regulatory approval. So they made their application to the National Energy Board in October of 2004, and they're hoping to receive approval this fall, 6 years after their application. So that's today, the National Energy Board process for a northern pipeline that is not ours, for the Alaska gas. I wish them the best. We're a modest investor in that project. TransCanada, if that project succeeds, would have a 5% interest. If not, we will have lost our development costs. And I think I've described for you at other times that we are funding the Aboriginal Pipeline Group, who is a one-third potential owner in that project. So TransCanada is highly interested, but we're not driving the project. We're a very small player in that project, but we certainly want it to succeed, just as we want this to succeed in a number of other projects.
Thank you, Tony. It sounds like you've said that at least 10 times, I know, to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On that, you know, again, with the link on this, and I think what we'll try and do, too, again, because the TC filing is 800-plus pages long here, is we'll ask maybe some of the very competent staff sitting in the front row here for TransCanada to help us along with that, with somewhat of an executive summary, so that we get the points, the basic points of where we're going on that. Did we have any other questions at this point for Mr. Palmer?
Minor one.
Go ahead, Representative Olson.
BC First Nations.
Representative Olson, through the chair. I will tell you that we've started to have some discussions with British Columbia First Nations. I won't take you through the Yukon circumstance. I've had that discussion with you before. We're in what I would call traditional pipelining territory in British Columbia. There are thousands of miles of pipeline that exist today. And in fact, TransCanada today has applications to extend its Alberta system into British Columbia to move British Columbia shale gas over the next several years. So we're in active discussions with parties to move shale gas over the next 3 to 5 years. And so we're having active discussions with them. That is familiar ground for pipelines. So we haven't resolved all items, but they appear that we're in a position on a route where there are thousands of miles of pipes that exist today. We're going to be building new ones in the next few years, and I will never say that there are no issues, but I think they're resolvable issues.
So it's getting better, as opposed to 18 months ago?
Representative Olson, through the chair, I don't see much difference for this project. The only thing I would say is that TransCanada's intention is to construct pipelines into British Columbia in the next 2 to 5 years, that we weren't doing so a couple of years ago. So we will have more direct experience on the ground in British Columbia in a very short period of time. We're actually having discussions with those parties now.
Thanks.
Thank you, gang. I would like to say again thank you to Commissioner Galvin for joining us here today, and maybe he'll come back and be here with us on Wednesday when we meet again, because he's got so much time right now.
He loves us.
Working on the budget, and he's only the Commissioner of Revenue, probably has lots of time on his hands. But this is a serious issue, you know. I mean, this is Alaska's future riding on this, folks, and hope we're all informed. Ask good questions, lots of good questions today, and we'll continue that. And Tony, appreciate your time and coming here. Always been available to talk to us. For people who don't have Tony's direct information, I know when I call him, he says, here's my cell phone, let's talk to me. So he's a good guy. Learn more all you can. But thank you, Tony. And with that, we will adjourn for today. Thank you.